Welcome back to The Calling. We are the Christchurch podcast where we talk a little bit about the meaning behind what people do and how they became what they are. I don't think we'd be abusing the metaphor to say that we have the bases loaded tonight. But on first, of course, we have Reverend Marek Zabriskie, who is just back from Cuba. So that really actually fits the theme pretty well, considering we're going to be talking about baseball. Second, we have Josh Barton, who is the youth minister here at Christ Church. And I'm going to leave the final introduction up to you, Marek, for our speaker who's going to be swinging for the fences.
Great to have you with us, Tyler. Thank you for coming out this way from Wilton. And
sure.
I've known you for, I think, 27 years now. You were probably just in college when I first met you at Vanderbilt with your baseball journalism scholarship.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been the mid-90s, when you came to St. Thomas in White Marsh, PA, right?
That's right. Yeah. And since then, you've worked for, I think, the San Jose Mercury and then the Riverside Press Enterprise.
Yes, I covered the Angels down there and then went up to Seattle for the late, great Seattle Post-Intelligencer, covered the Mariners there. I was the beat writer. And then I came to the New York Times in 2000.
And since then, you've also published a great book, History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. And you're back with us about the grandest stage, a history of the World Series.
Yes.
So that's so exciting, just coming off the World Series. And to begin with, you grew up in Flowertown, Pennsylvania. So you've just got the Phillies in your blood. What was it like, and how hard is it actually to cover something where you heavily favor one team as you have since you were a child?
Yeah, I've tried to look at it as an advantage, in the sense that I know a lot about the Phillies and their history, so I can maybe tell some stories that other people might not be able to tell or might not be as inclined to tell. This year when it was the Phillies against the Astros, so that immediately made me think of the 1980 League Championship Series when the Astros were in the National League. And we grew up outside Philly. Everybody believed that that was the greatest playoff series ever. You know, there were four extra inning games out of five and just excitement all the way around and comebacks and blown leads and everything. It was wild. And so I was able to, call on some of that history. I called Mike Schmidt. I called Greg Gross. I called a player or two on the Astros and leaned on some old interviews I did and put together something that nobody else wrote leading up to the series. So that's kind of how I look at it. Whatever I'm feeling deep down, I'm trying to use that professionally to tell the reader something relevant that they may not have known about.
Baseball certainly has evolved so much. I spoke to my father this evening and he told me that when he was growing up, back when he was like 9, 10, 11, he would hitchhike from Ridgewood, New Jersey into Yankee Stadium, and he'd go over to the dugout and get autographs from the players, and Charlie Keller was renting a house that summer in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and Red Rolfe, who was a pitcher who had become a coach at that point, was also living in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And when they asked him how he got to the stadium, he said, "I hitchhiked." He said, Charlie Keller said, "Would you like a ride back to Ridgewood?" And that became something where my father would meet him at the locker room door, and the security would let him in. He'd get to meet all the players.
Wow.
And he would ride home with Charlie Keller and Red Rolfe.
That is incredible.
In your book, you mentioned how, if you look back at the black and white photos, the men were in ties and coats and had hats. Women were in all their finery. The game's changed, and the culture's changed a lot, too. Now everyone shows up dressed as in any way they want. How do you think that's happened, where the game and the culture's changed so much?
Well, in that instance, it's merchandise. Now you look in the stands and you can count. We sit in the press box and behind always a group of fans, and you can always look and see the different jerseys. You sort of look at the names on the back. If you're at the Yankees game, you'll see anything from Munson or Ruth or Gehrig to Jeter and Judge, and everybody in between. So people come dressed as the players or they wear some sort of team gear. In fact, my brothers live in Texas now, and they came to the Astros stadium for game one of the World Series wearing all their Philly stuff. And, an Astros fan actually stopped them and wanted to take a picture with them because he's like, I was telling my friend, we would never wear Astro gear in Philadelphia, but you guys are brave enough to wear it down here, so I will take a picture with you. So it's a little bit different. Yeah, it's different environments.
Well, they know the Philadelphia crowds. I would never wear any kind of other outfits there.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So how about, you know, if you look at, when you talked about the baseball rings and how they treasure that World Series ring, and then, you know, you look at other things, you've got people gathering almost like a congregation. You've got sacrifices being made. You've got signs and rituals and people doing all sorts of little things to communicate back and forth. It's almost like priests standing at the altar, you know, genuflecting and crossing themselves. And do you sense any relationship between baseball and religion? Because there's almost like a religion to this game.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, the rituals that we see in baseball, I think, are probably more than we see in any other sport. Just because we can kind of, it lends itself to stopping and starting. It's not sort of constant motion. You can study the people. You know, where I look at the other sports, you know, hockey and basketball is sort of constant motion. Football is a stop-start sport, but there's so much going on in such a cluster of people, and plus you can't really see them with the helmets and everything. Baseball is start, stop, start, and everybody, you can observe everybody. You can see the little things that they do, and I think there is some similarity to, you know, witnessing or watching a church service from the congregation with all the rituals that we see up on the altar, and just the communal sort of spirit in the stands. It really is something that becomes, almost like a religion. I think that goes probably, though, for fans of all sports.
If you think about the movies that have been made about sports, only baseball has, like, The Natural, and it has Field of Dreams, and it has these sort of supernatural, spiritual stories written about it. And there's really, you don't see that in very many other sports.
Yeah, that's a good point. you know, there is some element of timelessness to it. The tradition of baseball, I mean, really, if you compare it to other countries, it's much different. But for our country, it goes back further than the other major sports. And so I think you can reach back for something of the past, and that kind of brings in the mystical elements of it. Well, it's hard to relate to maybe something that was going on in the black and white times. But, that's a big part of baseball history. And yeah, it kind of does lend itself to a sort of mysticism.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking, Tyler, with all the, like, baseball is constantly changing. Even this next year, they got new rules coming out and changing it. And does it feel like they're trying to, because we live in an age of TikTok and other things where it's like, you know, 20-second videos, 2-minute, you know, videos, everything to keep your attention. And here we have this beautiful game that takes 3 hours.
Right.
Do you see them really trying to keep up with the times as far as evolving and keeping the game moving?
That's definitely a goal. but the interesting thing is when you really dive into baseball history, you realize that that's always been a goal of baseball, going back hundred years, because every generation is faster paced than the one before. Mm-hmm. So you always have people sort of pontificating and worrying that baseball's slow pace is not going to keep up with modern times. Mm-hmm. And that was said in 1920, just as much as it said in 2020, and even before that. So baseball endures. Baseball always keeps going. But it is smart of them to try to cut down some of the dead time, because the numbers do show that, you know, the game has become longer. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a good thing if it's not action, if it's just standing around and waiting for the next pitch kind of thing. There's enough of that built into the game that they don't need to accentuate that. So they're trying to cut down on the times between pitches. They're trying to increase the action a little bit. And that's tough because teams in this information heavy era, data and analytics have really understood that, you know, the most efficient way to score runs is to put the ball over the fence. And the most efficient way to, not most efficient, but the most sort of fail safe way to get an out is to get a strikeout. Don't let them put it in play. So it becomes oftentimes just a power struggle. You know, I'm going to try to overpower you with the pitch, and the hitter's going to try to overpower you by hitting it into the stands. And a lot of the nuance is gone. So they're trying to find ways to maybe bring back the stolen base a little more and bring back the the craft of it beyond just the force.
Yeah.
You note that the football is kind of eclipsed baseball in terms of viewership. The Super Bowl, for instance, the amount of people that watch that, the amount of people that watch an average Sunday football game. Why do you think that's happened?
Yeah, football is the only thing really that people still watch as much now as they did 20, 30, 40 years ago, if not even more. I mean, everything on television has lower ratings than before because there's so many networks. There's so much, so many different, that word is silos that you can go into and you know, specialized channels for you or streaming service, whatever. But football is immune to it almost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a combination of fantasy leagues and gambling and the fact that it's just once a week. So it really doesn't mm-hmm. demand a whole lot of you.
Yeah.
You know, you gear up all week for Sunday at 1:00 and then you get 1 to 4, 1 to 4:30 and that's it. That's all it asks of you. You know, whereas baseball, you know, you might watch only 2 games a week, but you're still watching more baseball than you are football, but you're missing 5 games a week. So it's just a fundamentally different product, but I can't argue with the fact that baseball ratings and stuff is down. But I will say, if you look at it in context, that baseball has so many games. Baseball is a business. Each team has 81 home dates to sell. And even though attendance has dropped a little bit each year recently, and that's not the trend you want to see, they still average about 27, 28,000 people to an event 81 times a year. Plus all the minor leagues out there, all the games, all the eyeballs that watch these games every day. If you're a fan, 162 games, you're going to check in on most of them. That's a lot of time spent on baseball. So even if people say football's my favorite sport, it's a different product. There's nothing quite like baseball with the volume of games it's able to sustain as a business.
I had a question about gambling because you mentioned that.
Yeah.
I think I read that ESPN might be starting to get involved in doing something with gambling, and that also obviously betting has become legal in a lot of different states.
Right.
Do you think that that's going to change baseball?
Yeah, I was having a talk about somebody with involved in that today, actually, and it's good and bad. I mean, obviously, you know, with gambling, it's a different way of viewing the sport, for sure. It can bring more people to the TV or to the game if they're interested in it, because they have a bet on something during the game. You know, because it's more than just it. Really, what it is these prop bets or whatever. Like, is the guy going to hit a home run here, or are they going to score more than 6 runs this game, or whatever? All these little bets. Is there going to be a strikeout this inning? You know, all these things you can do, and it's kind of fun, except for the you know, the ugly side of betting. So it's a bit of a slippery slope that baseball's getting involved in. But I think the way they justify it is, well, it makes us all money. And if we can find some way to kind of regulate it, we should probably do that because people are going to do it anyway. So I don't know. I'm very skeptical of it, but it is sort of the way of the world now with legalization and with as easy as it is to place a bet on your phone.
Tyler, I wonder, because I love baseball and I've grown up playing it and just been like, love the game. Do you have one specific like baseball memory that just is your like absolute favorite, either as a fan or even a beat writer?
Yeah, I think the first thing I think of is being at the clinching game of the 1983 National League Championship Series with my dad in Philadelphia, seeing my team. I mean, I was 8 years old, so that's the context of it.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing my team, my heroes, get to the World Series, you know, to be the last team, one of the last two teams standing. That was so exciting. And just driving down Broad Street with my dad after the game, honking our horns, like everybody going crazy in Philadelphia. It's probably the happiest moment of my childhood. And even though they lost the World Series, those games that I went to in the World Series, you know, still mean a lot to me, to be able to be there on the grandest stage, you know, to see it, even in the afternoon. I mean, they don't have afternoon baseball games in the World Series anymore. I saw one of those. So really the fall of 83, for me being 8 years old and just completely, you know, baseball was like the biggest thing in my life, and my team was going all the way. So that was amazing. And that's probably where I start. And, it's when you ask a lot of players for their career highlight. A lot of times they start with their first game because you know, there's something irreplaceable about that.
So the sport I love is soccer. And this coming week, the World Cup starts. And that is truly a world event. There'll be people in every country in the world watching this. Is it somewhat of a misnomer to call the World Series when it's really the United States Series with Toronto Blue Jays possibly thrown in?
Yeah, it's a funny name. I mean, it was named at a time when they, you know, baseball was pretty much only played over here, and they called it the World's Championship Series as if it belonged to the world. Not that it represented the world. It was just sort of something for the world. This is the World's Championship Series. This is it. This is for everybody in the world. And now I think you could probably get away with it by saying, like, well, the world's best players do play over here. I mean, Shohei Ohtani, the greatest from Japan, is over here now. That's kind of where a lot of the best Japanese players aspire to be. That's where the best players from Latin America come over here to play. They play over there in the wintertime, but it's different. I mean, this is the pinnacle of baseball. So it's not, I guess, a World Series in the sense that you're not playing the champion from Japan, or the World Baseball Classic, they call it, is comes around every 4 years or so in spring training, and it's fun, you know. But it's a spring training tournament, you know, people just getting loose. So it's an odd sort of name, I guess. But I think it reflects baseball's predominance back then, and sort of America's kind of tendency to inflate everything over here as being the greatest and the best and the coolest in the world.
Well, you began your career peddling a little magazine, didn't you?
I did.
How old were you when you did that, and what was that magazine about?
Yeah, I started in middle school. I was 14 years old, and a friend of mine, we had the same schedule that year in seventh grade. So we would just sit in the back and kind of just jot down little trivia quizzes and little games and little lists about baseball, and we turned that into, you know, a little magazine. You know, we'd staple it together. It'd be just a few pages. And then one summer, after eighth grade, I just really, really got into it. And really grew to love the writing of it. You know, not just the list making and photocopies of baseball cards and stuff, like, actually writing, because I was very lucky to grow up, as a Philadelphia Inquirer reader. I mean, they had a writer named Jason Stark, who's still a great friend of mine, and was an early mentor of mine. And you know, just seeing his writing every day and all the other great writers they had there, Bill Lyon in particular, subscribing to Sports Illustrated, reading books, it just got me the notion that writing about baseball could be a really cool vehicle into the game. So I started writing a lot more, and the more you write, if you're good at it, or you can sense yourself getting better. So very quickly, I mean, I was naive in a sense, like I didn't know when I would send the magazine to sports writers and sports casters, I was not looking for publicity. I didn't think in those terms. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to get feedback about how I can be better, what they think and how I can get better at this. And one of them, George Vesey of the New York Times, who I ended up working with for many years, showed it to his sports editor and said, this might be a cute little story. Mm-hmm. And so they wrote a little story about it. Lucky for me, they put my address in there and how much the subscription cost. So we started getting so many checks from all over the country. It became a big sort of operation. My mom had to, you know, do all the business side of it so I could just focus on the writing. And what I realized is that once the media gets a hold of a good story, they all the different types of media want to do their version of it. So I was always sort of had an interview lined up or a TV appearance or something. And that was a really cool way for me to get into the business, because I empathize now with athletes who have to, you know, do interviews and talk about the same things a lot. And from there, it just grew. I mean, the Phillies, you know, started letting me in to do interviews when I was 15. So, you know, my high school years after school, I'd go down to the Veterans Stadium and do interviews there before the games. So that was a different way to grow up, but it really gave me the certainty that this was what I wanted to do. And knowing that from a very early age, I was able to sort of chart a course and just follow it.
So Tyler, you know, not every game is a great game, right? There are a lot of games that in every sport that just, they're kind of lackluster. How do you kind of take a game that's not necessarily, nothing really spectacular happened? And how do you make a story out of it?
Yeah, well, I did the beat for 12 years. And that means, like, you know, you follow one team around, basically that's your job. So I did the Angels for a year, like I said, the Mariners, Mets for two, and the Yankees for eight. And I gotta say, I never really, in writing the story of the team that day, as reflected in the game, you know, that was your job every day. And I found that if you're doing your job right and you know the players enough and you know the where each game fits in the daily soap opera of a team, I never really lacked for something to write. You know, even if it was a blowout game or a relatively uninteresting game, there was always something in there that I could find and latch onto, because it always meant, if you knew the stories and of each player and kind of where every player was in his journey, so to speak, you could find the meaning in something in that game as it relates to a player. So, you know, even if it's an 8-1 game and it's, you know, it's 8-1 in the third inning and that's how it stays, you know, there's usually someone who contributed a lot to that, or someone who had a rough game because of that. And then you extrapolate it into what that means in the course of the season. And there you go. You have your story. Hmm.
You've got such an incredible brain for stats. I think that's one of the things that sets you apart. You can just bring all this kind of metrics into your analysis of a game or a player or an event at a game. Were you always like that? And is there any other sport you know that's as stats-driven as baseball?
No, definitely not. There's just so many data points within a game. You know, so many different pitches, you know, 120 or so pitches for each team and nine innings and 162 games. And so there's so much to analyze. And, you know, a lot of the data out there now is frankly, you know, beyond me. You know, I'm not as well versed as as many at the, you know, all this information out there and what it all means. I mean, I have a general idea of what most of it means and where to find most of it. But I try to use the numbers to help tell stories. Because I think that's my wheelhouse, you know, and finding a statistical trend or something that, you know, will inspire me to maybe ask a player what that means or why, you know, why that is. And then that'll bring me this, you know, into a story of, well, how he developed that skill to get those numbers, or to be that type of player. So that's really where I'll use the numbers to kind of inform, what's happening on the field and try to explain that to the readers.
So how did you get to be such a great storyteller? Because I love in chapter 6 where you talk about, I think the title's in, It Wasn't Your Fault, Kid. And then you bring up Bill Buckner and the Red Sox World Series, where one play defined that man's the rest of his life, when the ball just trickled through his legs. And I was, I went to high school in Boston. So there is no Boston fan who ever watched that just would forget that play. But the way you told it was so compassionate and so thorough, and you added things with the Seinfeld episode and all, and later parts of Buckner's life before he died in 2019, that you got this kind of more fulsome portrait of him. How did you get to be such a good storyteller? And what would you tell others listening? You know, if you're telling a story, hear key things to make it come alive.
Yeah, well, thank you. I don't know. I mean, I read a lot, like I said, as a kid. I didn't necessarily read a lot of fiction, you know, a fair amount, but mainly just read baseball stuff, stories about baseball and other sports from good sports writers. And I think there's a certain, say some absolutes you have to hit. You know, if you introduce something, you have to get to it fairly quickly, get back to it fairly quickly. But I've always felt like as you tell a story, that nobody owes you their attention. Nobody owes you their readership. You have to keep them engaged and earn it. Because if I'm reading something and it's just not really gripping me, I'm not going to finish it. I'm not going to invest my time in it. And everybody's time is finite and valuable. So, I try to write it in a way that, it's not flashy. That's not what I'm getting at, but just write it in a way that keeps you interested and keeps you hooked and doesn't rely on sort of stale, cliched kind of language, but just keeps you. I think it's important to be crisply written, and I think it's important to research as much as you can or talk to as many people as you can, because even if you don't use it in their words, it just makes your words better because you have better information. So, and fortunately, if you pick a subject that you like, you'll enjoy doing the research and you'll enjoy digging and finding more about it and talking to people about it. So, all of that's naturally going to help you tell the story.
Your parents are very active Episcopalians. Your father was a senior warden at the former church where I served as rector for 23 years. Your mother was on the vestry. Your parents both chaired the Episcopal Community Services in Philadelphia. And you were raised in the Episcopal Church and married in the Episcopal Church. And
yep,
I had the honor
by
to
you.
Officiate. Yeah.
Yep.
Uh-huh. So you know about that sense of calling and having a vocation. How would you describe finding your calling and what it means to, serve as a baseball writer, but more than just as a job, but as a calling?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I never classify myself as lucky to have this job because I always worked really hard at it, but I was very lucky to obviously have a lot of advantages, but I was very lucky to identify what I wanted and identify that calling at a very young age. A lot of people, understandably, take a long time to find their calling, but I discovered it as an early teen. And so to me, that really helped because it gave me, just competitively, it gave me, more experiences than other people. But it helped because it didn't have to force anything. I didn't have to say, well, I guess I got a job. I got to get a job, so I guess I got to be interested in carpentry or finance or whatever. Like sales, I guess I got to be interested in this. Like it was a passion. Mm-hmm. And I think when you have a calling, you having a passion is a part of it, right? So not everybody who has a job has a calling to that job. They just do it because you have to have a job and you got to have something to do and make money. But when you have a calling, I think you really bring a passion to it and it makes your job a joy and it makes you be as good as you can at it because you enjoy it so much. So it may not be it is not the profession where you could make the most money, but the trade-off is that you get a lot of intrinsic sort of pride in what you do and just fun. So it's fun.
So we thought it would be fun to kind of just do a little bit of a lightning round where we
All right.
kind of ping our maybe a little more esoteric questions at you and just get kind of your quick answer. Best franchise right now?
Well, the Astros right now. They're the world champs. It's easy to say, but they've been to the LCS 6 years in a row, 4 out of the last 6 World Series. I don't know how they'll sustain it because they keep losing a lot of the architects of it. Mm-hmm. But for now, they've got the best.
What do you think about a salary cap in baseball?
It'll never happen. So, they blew up a season over in the 94th. World Series
right.
never happened because they fought that battleground and held that line. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't like it how someone will get out on the free agent market, let's say, and it's just impossible to think that many teams have a chance at him. You know, I feel like every, but I do feel though that like every team has a pathway to success. It's just, you have to have different expectations as a fan. Whereas in the other sports, because of the economic structure, there's maybe fewer limits on what you can dream about.
Yeah. You mentioned in your book, like how Kansas City had to, like when they won, it was basically, they were showing also the rest of the league too.
I'm glad you noticed that. That was an important, that was an important part of the book. And not a lot of people have picked up on it, but, when Kansas City won, I feel like that was the most important championship in the last couple of decades, just because it shows that, it shows every fan in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and, all these so-called small markets that, you know, this is possible if we get our act together here and everything breaks right. We can win the World Series. The Royals did it. The Royals made it twice in a row.
Who is the most overpriced player in history?
In history? Well, in Yankee history around here, Jacoby Ellsbury. I was just looking at him the other day. The Red Sox paid $21 million for him to play for them for his full 7 years, and he gave them great value. You know, lead the league in stolen bases a few times. He was almost an MVP, won a couple World Series. Then the Yankees agreed to pay him $21 million a year for 7 years. So they paid him seven times what the Red Sox paid him, and he was terrible. He played 4 years, very mediocre. He was hurt all the time, and then he was hurt the last 3 years. He didn't play at all. So it's hard to say. A lot of guys make, you know, good money for low performance, but when you think of the Yankees paying seven times what the Red Sox paid for the same guy and getting, you know, nothing from him, whereas the Red Sox got a lot, you know, that's the first one I thought of.
Bobby Bonilla for the Mets.
I tell you,
still gets paid.
If I was Bobby, if I would take a contract like that all the time, man. You give me a million a year, whatever, for when you're 40 to when you're 65, something like that, like. That's you can waste all your money and still know that you'll be just fine in your old age. Yeah,
that's right.
who's the most exciting player today?
Well, Shohei Ohtani. I mean, he's the best player in the world. The idea that you can be an elite slugger and a great pitcher. You know, that you can be Bryce Harper and let's say, you know, Zach Wheeler or something to keep it with the Phillies in one package. That's amazing. You know, you could be a number one starter and the best, or one of the best sluggers in the league, and you can run like he does. I mean, he's just an incredible athlete. We've never seen anything like him in baseball.
I have a weird question about this. Does he belong in the American League if he's a guy who can hit and pitch? He's for the Angels, right? So shouldn't he be in a league where you can actually, without a designated hitter?
Well, they both have designated hitter now.
So it doesn't matter.
But it doesn't matter. But they actually changed the rule for him. So, you know, so when you can, so, you know, when he's the pitcher, he can also be the designated hitter. And like when he comes out of the game, he doesn't have to come out of the lineup. That's a wrinkle that they introduced just because it didn't quite work. It wouldn't quite work otherwise. Like if he was a pitcher, if he was pitching, then he'd be in the lineup officially as a pitcher. And if when he came out from the mound, he'd have to be done from the game itself. You know, so now they can, a DH can pitch.
I didn't realize that. That was the reason they changed the rule.
Yeah, basically it's like he's the DH. That's his job. And he also pitches certain days. They just have to find a way to classify it. He sort of defies that categorization.
Well, we've loved talking to you again, Tyler. And I want to ask you this closing question. What would you say to a young person who still hasn't sorted out what they want to do with their life? How would you coach them to discern their calling?
Well, the easiest answer is just to find what you do best and then do your best with it. You know, do your best at it. Go all out. I got here sort of by specializing. And some people will tell you don't specialize. You know, be as broad, have as many different talents as you can. I don't know. I'm sure that works for a lot of people. But my whole thing was just find the single thing that I love most, and, you know, as a profession, and just go for it with everything I had. So if you love, whatever you love, just do everything you possibly can within that area and make that a career. So.
Well, Well, Tyler, thank you so much for joining us on the calling. You have a book out, The Grandest Stage, The History of the World Series, which you can get, of course, on Amazon or your local bookstore or here at the Christ Church bookstore. And thank you again for listening to The Calling. If you want to comment on this, you can write to us at thecalling@christchurchgreenwich.org. Tyler, thank you very much, and we'll see you guys soon.